Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we hear from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. If you're a regular listener to this programme, indeed if you were tuning in at this time last week, you'll be well aware that UBS is interested in addressing the big questions that shape the world. To help best answer them, they've been seeking out a number of Nobel laureates in the economic sciences to ask them to share insights and discuss their research. This week, we're hearing from another such eminent mind, Finn Kidland, winner of the 2004 Nobel Prize for his work on the time consistency of economic policy and the driving forces behind business cycles. Finn is sitting down with us on the Bulletin with UBS today to talk about that and to discuss the regulation of monetary policy, his fascination with exploring the application of his theories in interdisciplinary fields, and, we trust, plenty more besides. Finn Kidland, welcome to the programme. I wonder, in terms of if we look at, you know, big questions, big policy questions, it seems to me that there's not a tremendous amount of reassurance out there currently that governments, presidents, are particularly invested in long-term strategic thinking. I wonder, do you think that's is that a fair observation? And if not, what needs to be done or what could be done to address that short-termism in the sort of political classes?
I think that's correct, but I think it varies depending on what part of the world you're talking about. So in the past couple of years, quite a bit of uncertainty has been introduced by the United States. I think nothing much has changed in the Scandinavian countries. My home country, Norway, I think is fairly stable politically and trustworthy. So, and probably the same in Sweden and Denmark. It's not too surprising from a theoretical standpoint that short-termism sometimes arises. It's kind of what theory would predict. After I discovered the principle that optimal government policy is timing consistent, it's sort of what you suspect will happen in countries. You suspect it would happen in countries with weak political institutions. It's a bit surprising maybe that the United States would be the country embarking on issues like trade restrictions, etc., because that's a perfect example of short-termism. Most economists agree that in the long run, trade across nations is beneficial to all nations. And so I kind of regard this short-termism in the United States as sort of naive, suggesting that whoever came up with it is either has not very trustworthy advisors, or or he himself is, or they themselves maybe, if a whole party is in agreement that they haven't really thought through, or they don't have the ability to think of the long-run implications.
I guess this, I mean, I know you've written and spoken extensively before about why, given that backdrop that you've described there for us, it's very important to have central bank independence, for example. And I guess if you have those kinds of governance structures that do sit without the political ecosystem, or largely without it, that demonstrates the efficacy of that, doesn't it? It shows how you can mitigate against some short-termism. Is that enough, though? I mean, you mentioned how if we look to the US in the last couple of years, it does seem to go against so much of the received wisdom, if you like, about trade or about how to conduct day-to-day politics. Do you think sort of more needs to be done? Is it the job of economists like yourself to say, well, hang on a minute, this doesn't seem very sensible?
I think we readily point out what the issues are or what the problems are. It's not so easy to come up with a long-term solution. I mean, the example of independent central bank, that has worked very well in the countries that can maintain that institution. It's much harder to think of a way you could commit to good future fiscal policy or to good long-run fiscal policy. And admittedly, fiscal policy for the long run has to be more important than monetary policy. So I sometimes half jokingly suggest that if some hotshot young economist can come up with a solution to the commitment problem, analogously to monetary policy and independent settlement bank, if someone can come up with a solution in the fiscal arena, 30 years later, he's likely to stand in front of the King of Sweden and accept an important prize. I mean, that saying that just suggests how important that issue is and how potentially damaging it can be to a nation not to be able to do so.
Well, and indeed, I guess how difficult it is to come up with such a solution because we'd be there already. Yes, exactly. So at the risk of, in a sense, getting you to repeat yourself, how do you best commit people not just to undertake good policy and good strategic thinking, but to adhere to it going forward? So, I mean, is there a secret to doing that, or is it just about thinking strategically, being interested, being inquisitive, talking to the right people? There are no shortcuts, presumably.
I'm not aware of any shortcuts. It helps to have good institutions and maybe the right mentality. For some reason, and I can't really point to why it works so well in Norway. But so in Norway, occasionally every 4 or 8 years, there could be a change in administration from the more leftist Labour Party being the major player to a coalition of centre to right-oriented parties. You don't notice any difference. All Norwegians seem to, maybe I'm overstating that, but all Norwegians seem to agree on the most major issues. And that provides for a certain amount of trust and, more importantly, ability to predict the future, which is very important for long-run growth. The main private economy decisions that result in long-run growth, they have to do with activities, research and development of new products, new ways of making things. They can be costly and with uncertain outcome as they take place. And then the returns come 5-10 years into the future, spread over that period. Similarly, with building new productive capacity to take advantage of the new technologies. Also very costly activities with returns coming over a period of 10 or even sometimes more, if it's a big factory, into the future. But those future returns can be influenced very much by the government, by the tax environment, by the regulatory environment. And if these players, the investors, let's say, or the decision makers are worried about the possibility of policy in the future that will ruin their calculations, they're more likely to be hesitant to carry out those decisions. And so as a result, the nation as a whole will suffer in the sense of being poorer than their potential. And so this is clearly a problem, a bigger problem in some areas of the world, like Latin America is notorious. Many countries in Latin America are notorious for short-term policies, willy-nilly introducing trade restrictions or the central government interfering in the central bank's behavior, etc. One can even see differences across neighboring countries, like politically Chile seems to work significantly better than the neighbor Argentina. So one asks oneself, what's the secret? But there's no easy solution to my mind.
Indeed. I wanted to ask you, Finn, just to change tack slightly about, I guess, a sort of interdisciplinary approach. And it was funny, I was talking with another Nobel laureate, Michael Spence, recently, and he was talking about how if you're looking at creative and innovative solutions to these kind of very deep-rooted problems that you've already been talking about, the most interesting findings can happen where disciplines meet. And I know this is something you've talked about before, of course, and I think am I right in thinking you described yourself once as an accidental economist almost? So given that, yes. You seem the right man to ask. Why do you think that is? Is it because there's fresh insight or there's a spark that comes when maybe two complementary or non-complementary disciplines sort of crash into each other? Why is that an important thing even for economists to think about?
So I have been in environments inhabited by many disciplines most of my life at the business school in Bergen, where I got my start, but also Carnegie Mellon University is maybe one of the foremost examples of the benefits of interdisciplinary work or interdisciplinary thinking. For example, most of the economists at Carnegie Mellon are housed in the business school, and that means that they can easily interact with people in accounting or marketing or even operations research. My first couple of papers were examples of operations research articles. At least to me, it generates a certain amount of dynamism that is harder to repeat if it's a pure, let's say, economics department, where people have much more narrow interests and either they don't care or they don't feel a need to look at wider perspectives. In the past few years, I've had the opportunity to go to conferences attended by scientists from different areas. For example, before this trip, I just came back from a trip to China in Shanghai, where they managed to get 26 Nobel laureates together in one conference. Three of them were economists, the others were from physics, chemistry, medicine, and so on. We were all expected to sit through everyone's talks, and it's very interesting. There's a similar conference that takes place in Vietnam every other year, and similarly, very interesting. So I have great respect for scientific findings in other areas. For example, if people from other fields say that worsening of the climate is a real danger, I take them seriously. Or if a laureate tells me that the antagonism towards GMOs is completely misplaced, there's no scientific basis for it, then this is actually a laureate who had 130 laureates or something like that sign on to the notion that GMOs, they're perfectly safe. He calls it a crime against humanity to ban them, which is the case in some areas of the world. The bottom line is that being in an environment where you can think about wider implications of in some cases, findings that you have come up with yourself, but you discover there are broader applications. The time inconsistency issue I see everywhere. once you realize that problem, then it's a problem that especially becomes serious if we're talking about incentives to accumulate something over time. Accumulate physical capital, accumulate human capital, accumulate, say, government debt by government bonds, then the temptation will arise. Well, once it's been done, then if the government perceives some crisis, which is seems to be easy for governments to do, then they can turn around and try to surprise people by taxing them or... In the case of government bonds, this is what Latin American countries have done multiple times. You issue government debt at a fixed nominal interest rate, and then you run hyperinflation, and the hyperinflation reduces the real value of that debt to virtually zero. I mean, one would assume that you cannot do that over and over again because people learn and they realize this is a possibility, and once you lose your credibility, it's hard to rebuild it. And that's a problem, for example, for Argentina these days. There's a new administration run by Macri. He took over from Cristina Kirchner Fernandez. Cristina was clearly a very short-term oriented person, and Macri is trying to institute more reasonable policies, but because of that checkered past, it's very difficult to suddenly turn around and try to do something reasonable for the long run. For one thing, voters have to have the patience to wait for the good outcomes that will not come in a month or two.
And voters often not the most patient bunch. I want to ask you, Finn, a complete change of tack. I've seen a number of sort of portraits of you and films of you, and there's always, almost inevitably, whether it's in your office or elsewhere, there's always a guitar in the background. And I'm right in thinking you're a blues fan. Is this right? First, and I just wondered, it's interesting, I guess, for our listeners to get a sense of not just, you know, Finn on his downtime, but what does that give you if you lose yourself in music, whether that's playing or going to gigs or whatever? Is that also useful? We talked about, you know, interdisciplinary, challenging your expectations, hearing from experts in completely different fields. Does music give you that? Is it about freedom? Is it escapism, I wonder? What does it mean? What does your love of music mean?
I'm not really a philosopher, so this sounds almost like a philosopher.
It's a little bit philosophical, I suppose.
I think in general, Norwegians are kind of down to earth. They don't really think in highfalutin terms. Practicing guitar and taking guitar lessons is something I've done now for about 9 or 10 years. To the extent I can, I plan my activities around the usual timing of my guitar lesson, which can only be on a Thursday or a Friday. And now it's true, I've always been interested in, or I've loved music. Even as a child, I remember listening to Radio Luxembourg, which is where we would get to hear the newest tunes. The interest in blues is something that came slowly over time, I would say, after I was an adult. And once I discovered the blues, it goes back to the roots of these people. It started in the United States, but Britain was extremely important in that sense. I mean, in Britain, they really, really accepted the blues and became, to some extent, the forerunners. Eric Clapton, for example, is one of the greatest blues guitarists there is. Now, I'm kind of selective. I do think the guitar is king of all instruments. So I don't care so much for blues with horns. There's got to be a guitar or two, even better. And I've collected a few guitars, a couple because they're just great guitars, and purely acoustic, a 1940 0018 Martin, and a 1952 Gibson ES-350, which can be plugged in. I mean, it can be played acoustically, but it can also be plugged in. Then I have two or three others that are very good. And then I have some medium quality that I happened to buy because I was in some location for long enough that I can't be away for that long without the guitar. So I was in Seoul, Korea for 4 weeks, and I bought a guitar there that I then brought home. And then that's the guitar every year for the past 5 years, I've gone to Qatar, to Doha, to teach a course for Carnegie Mellon. So staying there for 8 weeks, that's too long to be without the guitar. And I have one permanently stationed in Pittsburgh, where I go to visit from time to time. I once stationed at my mother's house in Norway. So in the end, I have 11 guitars.
Wow, that's incredible. Well, there you go, Finn. I wasn't expecting to be talking about Martins and Gibsons and mentioning Eric Clapton, but I'm very glad I asked you about it because it's absolutely fascinating. Finn Kidland, thank you very much for chatting to us, and thank you for telling us about your 11 guitars as well.
Well, thank you for having me.
Music to the ears, indeed. Thanks again to Finn, bringing us to the end of this 222nd edition of The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. To read more from and about Finn Kidland, and to discover how Nobel perspectives shape the UBS worldview, head to ubs.com and search Nobel Perspectives. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.